Morning, everyone. Welcome to Friends Church. What's with this weather, huh? It's supposed to be mountain biking right after this. That's not going to happen. I've been doing a lot of research recently around mental illness. The last stat I read probably was the most troubling to me. It says every Canadian will be touched by a mental illness in their life. Whether you struggle with mental illness, whether someone you love does, whether someone you interact with does, we all do. And fundamentally, here, one of the things we spend a lot of time on in terms of our spirituality is how we love our neighbor. And what happens when our neighbor struggles? What happens if our spouse struggles? What happens if our children struggle? What happens if we struggle? What do we do? How do we love? So we're going to take 2 weeks. The first week we're going to explore kind of what mental illness is because, you know, if I have a bad day, I'll say I'm depressed. No, I just had a bad day. There's other people who struggle with this day in, day out, every day of their lives. So even the language we use has to kind of get cleaned up and figure out, well, what are we talking about here? How do we help? Who do we help? When do we need to help? So I'm going to invite you all back, starting not this Sunday, but next Sunday, May 19th. We'll talk about the problem. And on the 26th, one of my friends who's had a pretty much a lifelong struggle with mental illness is going to come on stage. Just help us understand, what is it like to be in that shoes? Now, for some of you, you know that. You live that. And part of the reason we're doing it is so that without you having to tell everyone in your life, this is the kind of stuff I struggle with, someone else can speak it for you. So I want to encourage you to come out. Bring anybody in your life who you think needs to know this. Bring them out. Tell them you got to come out and check this out. Because here, we're about loving our neighbors and loving them well. And I think this issue is one we got to tackle. So I want to just invite you guys to come out, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday for this thing. It runs for 2 weeks. I've been spending some time lately thinking about how in our legal system we punish criminals. Now, it's one little piece of this puzzle, so we're not going to go into that rabbit hole. But if you're in jail and you do something bad, what do? They throw you in a room and don't let anyone talk to you for a chunk of time. They call it solitary confinement. They force you to be alone. Why is it that that's how we punish our most hardened criminals? I was on a flight recently, and it was a long flight, so I watched all the movies that I like to watch, so all the violent movies were done. So I was like digging deep in the catalog of movies, and I found this movie called Papillon. Has anyone seen? It was a remake. The one I saw was a remake. Okay. Pardon my pronunciation of the names on this one. Okay. I would call her up to do all the pronunciations, but we're going to do our best here. It's about a safecracker named Henri. And Henri gets framed for murder and goes to a French penal colony in French Guiana. And so the movie is all about kind of his time here. And so basically the movie starts by saying, if you try and escape, we're going to throw you in solitary confinement for 2 years. What happens? Henri thinks, oh, I'm going to escape. He hardly, like, his plan is so lame. Like, it's like he gets 2 feet out the prison doors and gets caught, and they throw him in solitary confinement for 2 years. No one talks to him. Once in a while, he'll see someone. He has to stick his head out the slot in the door for them to cut his hair so his hair doesn't get too long. All by himself. 2 years. And he makes it through. Of course, Henri being Henri, he thinks, I'm going to escape again, or I'm going to try and escape again. This time he makes it further, and he gets turned in by a missionary, actually. It's kind of a brutal story, right? Gets dragged back to the prison, gets 5 years of solitary confinement. Could you imagine stuck in a room with your thoughts for 5 years? You don't see anybody. You don't talk to anybody. They open the door after the 5 years, and they're kind of shocked that he's still alive. Immediately, he feigns that he's gone crazy, or maybe he's crazy. We're not quite sure at this point, but everyone believes him. You know, anyone who's had 5 years of solitary confinement has got to be nuts, right? And so they take Henri, and they put him in kind of the hospital, or the clinic. And of course, Henri being Henri, he escapes again, right? This time he makes it, though. But he spent a total of 7 years by himself in a room. No TV, no yard time, no someone to talk to. He hasn't been touched by another human being other than to pull his hair out and snip it off. 7 years. How long could you go without interacting with another human being at all? Some of you with kids right now are like, yeah, I could. I got some time in me. A friend of mine did a 10-day silent retreat. 10 days, he doesn't get to say a word. Now, he's even with other people, but not a word to anybody. It's like day five, they all just start bawling. They're just like, and the people who lead the thing are like, and go. There you go, right? It's so mentally difficult. I was like, he's like, you should try it. I'm like, why would I do that? I have another friend, infinitely more crazy. Him and a few of his friends, I think there's four of them, they went down to a retreat center in someplace Central America. I'm not sure where it was. And basically they opened up kind of a dorm room. Bed, bathroom, nothing. Put it in, close the door for a month. He voluntarily shut himself into a room for a month. He said he came out, they were all just crazy. Like just nuts. So the question I want to ask you guys today is this. How long could you go completely alone? How long could you go? Week? Could you do that month? A year? And what would happen if you went a little bit past? You're like, okay, I could do 5 days. What happens if you went to 7 or 10? What would happen to you psychologically? You see, we're in this series called Soul Care. And I'm not sure who all was here last week, but Tom talked about this idea of this energy wells. When I learned about it, I learned about it as bowls. There's like a bowl of energy. And the topmost bowl is a really great bowl. That's the one we use all the time. We use the energy, and then we sleep, and the energy is refilled, right? It's like I go for a hard bike ride, I sleep, have a good night's sleep, and I have something to eat. Next day, I feel great. But has anyone ever had that moment where you had a good night's sleep, and your alarm goes off, and you're like, oh, I am not recharged? The idea is that there's deeper wells inside of us, deeper kind of bowls of energy, that when we use that energy, it takes a significant amount of time to recharge it. And the deepest bowl, the bowl that, you know, we go to very, very seldomly, that bowl can take years to recover from, to refill that bowl. And if you were at that message, you're probably doing what I was doing, which was calibrating, how deep in the hole am I? How deep into that deep bowl have I gotten myself? And part of soul care is the work of recharging those systems, that inner work to recharge the systems. But the thing is, normally when we hear these things, we're thinking, be by ourselves, right? I should meditate by myself a bit more. I should go off by myself a bit more. I should maybe do a retreat by myself some more. And there's truth to that. That does help recharge the system. If you're parents with young kids right now, chances are, you know, a nap would be amazingly recharging. But for many of us, we're exploring how do we refill those bowls? How do we get that energy back, that deep energy? And that's what we're talking about as soul care. And while you can do some of this alone, and it's great to do it alone, there's another way to do this that I think is pretty profound. And I think actually it kind of throws on its head how we think this normally goes. And to tell you this story, I want to tell you, or to tell you the concept, I want to tell you a story. And it's a creation story. So have any of you guys realized that there's three different creation stories in the Bible? And they're all different. So today I want to talk about the second creation story. We already had a chat at the beginning of the service, and I was like, I'll try and keep my voice nice, and he's like, it's all good. He's my buddy. He came in and say hi already this morning. So, oh, isn't it so sad when you hear that? Okay, we're actually going to talk about people at his age in a few minutes, so bear with me. Creation story. The story that I tell, I want to tell it from a particular way of looking at it. For those of you who are new here, we often look at the Bible through different lenses. There's not just one way to look at the Bible. There's many lenses. And looking at the lens officially is called a hermeneutic. That's what I studied in school, hermeneutics. And so today, I want to use a specific hermeneutic to look at this creation story. And it's a hermeneutic called an etiology. Big word, nice, huh? Spend a lot of money to learn that word. I don't actually know what it means, but... No, what it means is, it's a story that describes how we got to here. So let me tell you the story through an etiological lens. There's a little boy, and I'll use a little boy because I get little boys a bit better than little girls. Little boy's out playing with his buddies, right? Rough and tumble, they're having a great time, and all of a sudden, all the boys take off. Little boy's sitting by himself, going... Where did everyone go? And of course, you know the story. He got ghosted, right? His friends took off and didn't want to play with him anymore. At first, he kind of like tries to keep playing, and maybe they'll come back, or maybe they'll, you know, I don't know. And pretty soon, you can, you know, the tear starts to roll down his eyes or down his cheek. Being alone sucks. No one to play with. So he runs home crying, and he comes to his mom, and he's like, Mom, Mom. Like, she's like, what happened? She gives him a big hug and holds him. He's like, you know, snotty nose. Oh, they took off on me, you know. And you can tell he's just torn up inside. And so his mom tells him the second creation story. She says, did you know that one day, long ago, God created a little boy? God's got, you know, piques his interest. But God thought, it's not really good for little boys to be alone. They need people to play with. Of course, the boy's like, yeah. So what God did is he said, okay, I have a little boy. It's not good for him to be alone, so I'm going to create someone to play with. How about this? I'll create a parrot, because they can make talking sounds, right? So he brings the parrot to the little boy and says, hey, is this a good companion? Would you rather have a parrot than other little boys to play with? We all know the answer. Little boy's like, no, parrots suck. I'm a little boy, you know. So mom says, okay, so God created a fluffy dog. You like dogs, don't you? Yeah. So he took the fluffy dog and he brought it to the boy and said, is this a good companion for you? And even though the little boy loves dogs, he's still going, they're not as fun as little boys. You know, you can shoot them and they play dead, but they don't shoot you back, and then, you know, it's just no fun. So God created all these different things and brought them to the little boy and said, is this a good companion? Is this a good companion? Is this better than other little boys to play with? And the answer all the way through was no. And so God took the little boy and caused him to go to sleep. Now, what you guys don't get, and I can't do in English, the original language had a different word for little boy. In English, little boy has a gender to it, right? The word they use is the word ish. And ish is like a member of humanity, a single member of humanity. So the story isn't about, is it good for little boys or little girls? It's not good for people to be alone. And so God took Ish and put Ish to sleep and took a piece of the flesh of Ish and made a companion just like Ish, but maybe a little bit better. And when Ish woke up, he saw what God created, and he's like, now we're talking. And in Hebrew, the way you say something was made from Ish is you say Ish Ish. Ish Ish comes out of Ish. And the mother says to the little boy, did you know that there's an Ish Ish for you out there? The boy goes, and when you find this Ish Ish, you'll never be alone. You'll have someone to love and to play with and to hang out with. And the boy, of course, says, I want that now, Mom. She says, okay, it's going to take some time. But you won't be alone forever. There's Ish, and there's Ish-Ish. How many of us have found our Ish-Ish? How many of us have found that it's not good to be alone? It's okay to be alone. But as you hear as the different stories I tell, it's got problems. How many of us have given up on looking for Ish-Ish? How many of us have done that with friends? Because Ish-Ish can be romantic, but can be just a relationship. Someone who you connect with, someone for a time that's this incredible friend. How many of us need to put our names back in the pool again? Go back to the dating site. Reach out to friends that we haven't seen in a while. Talk to that person at work that we're going, hey, you want to go for coffee? Can we get to know each other? Maybe you're my Ish-Ish. How many of us need to take a step out and risk, have the courage to be vulnerable so we can find that companion? I always find it interesting when I read science. Science talks about, especially in the work of a guy named Stan Tatkin, he says we're dyadic creatures, meaning we're good in pairs. And it's kind of like, really? You figure that out now? You know, the Greeks had this story that humanity originally was two people, and then they got torn apart. And then they're running around looking for their other part to create the whole again. Humanity is two people. We've been exploring these topics for as long as we have writings. That we actually do better with another human being. Think about that little boy. If he found his Ish-Ish, what would happen to his soul? We've all felt it, right? Part of soul care has to do with other people. That we can say definitively. How it works? That gets a little more complex. Okay, I want to tell you one more story. I've told you guys this story once before, but it's my favorite, so bear with me. I'm going to tell you guys from a different perspective. There's a gentleman, and he's driving on a freeway. And you all know where the story's going because you know I have wicked road rage, right? And dude's got road rage just like I got. But he's got it a lot more complex because he's sitting in this car, and his wife's sitting next to him, and his kid's sitting in the back seat. And him and his wife have, as long as they've been together, they have this thing where they're driving down the road, something happens, he gets mad, what do you think she does? No elbowing your neighbor at this point, please. Right? She gets mad because she doesn't like his anger and he's yelling and screaming and swearing in front of their kid. And so now he gets mad, she gets mad at him, and then they get sullen, and it's like 3 days of just hell between them. And so they need to drive someplace, and they're on the freeway, and the guy's driving, and he knows. It's just like, as soon as they get into the car, him and his wife are like, there's this whole, like, silent battle of, like, resentment between them. He's, like, out of the corner of her eyes, watching her the whole time. She's kind of, like, giving him this, like... And so someone in front of him kind of cuts in front a little bit close. He's like, yeah. You know, he's pushing all the anger down, don't let it out. He's just like... And she's looking at him like... Someone does something else dumb, and he's like literally biting his cheek and punching his leg to try and like keep the anger inside, right? And she's just eyeballing him the whole time like, don't you freaking dare in front of her. Finally, someone in front of them just slams on the brakes. And to avoid getting in an accident, he slams on the brakes. They both hit the steering wheel. She hits the seatbelt. True story, folks. This has actually happened. The guy has been holding in his anger for how long? Someone just about tried to kill his wife and his kid. You can't control your anger in that situation, can you? Losing your mind at the person in front of you has got to be like a God-given right or something. And so as he slams in, out of the corner of his eye, he sees his wife, he sees his kids. It's just like, oh, I cannot hold this back. And he's just about to blow up. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees his wife. She grabs the bottom of her shirt, lifts it up over the top of her head, and shows her bare chest to the car in front of him. What started out as pure, unadulterated rage, like this is this moment where his brain just kind of blew up, and it's just like, what? Pretty soon, he is laughing his ass off. She's like trying to primly tuck her shirt back in, like, oh, that's no big deal. You know, she can't. Now she's laughing, and then 10 seconds later, he's like pretending to do his shirt again, and they start laughing. The kid's laughing. They're howling. You see how that story goes? His best work, his very best work, was to suppress his anger. Think of his soul in that moment. There is so much rage in there. Like, his patience is zero. Anyone does anything wrong, he's losing it. He's holding so much anger inside of himself, and he's doing his best. He's literally doing his best. He's talking, okay, it's not a big deal. If they catch you, it's no big, you know, don't worry. They're not, you know, he's doing everything he can to try and talk himself off the ledge. But he's so full of anger. She does one insanely skillful thing. Can we all agree? Insanely skillful. He goes from pure rage to, like, I think I might be peeing in my pants. I'm laughing so hard. Think about that. Normally, the next 3 days, you know, road rage leads to hurt feelings and resentment, and you're always that guy, and quit being an ass, and, you know, all that stuff. Now, they're at a party, and they catch the eye across, and he does one of these things to her, and pretty soon they're, like, giggling to each other across the room, right? For years later, they're telling this story. She could do for him what he couldn't do for himself. She could do for him what he could not do for himself. If soul care is finding health and joy and peace inside, sometimes we need another person to get us there. We need an insanely skillful person to get us there. She soothed his soul. In a moment of just insane, we had a couples workshop yesterday. Four incredibly brave couples all trying to figure out, how does this work? How do we shift our partners? How do we get them from, you know, a horrible state to a healthy state? How do we soothe their souls? It's a question. Do you know how someone soothes your soul? If you're in a moment of rage and someone flashes the person in front of you, I'd like to put that on my list just as an FYI. Solid work there. But what if someone gives you a gift? Or what if someone, you know, helps you with something? Or what if somebody, you know, says nice things about you? Does that do it? What happens if somebody, you know, those people who, you're in a bad mood and you just know, if I go to them, we're going to be howling in 10 minutes. They just know how to get me laughing. And once I'm laughing, a lot of that stuff just goes away. Or that person who, you know, you're kind of all over the place, and when you talk to them, it just feels like they get your soul somehow, and you just feel so calm and peaceful around them. Do you know what you need from people to soothe your soul? And then because it's Friends Church, the question then becomes, do you know how to soothe their soul? Do you know how to get your kids from that foul mood to something softer? Do you know how to get your partner from feeling angry to feeling laughter? Do you know how to get your colleagues from, you know, focused on work to actually there's another person in this room and that's okay? Do you know those things? Because wouldn't that be part of soul care? Having the skills and the talents to shift the people in our lives to healthy places and to be shifted to healthy places. Okay, I want one more story, and this is the one from Benjamin. Crazy psychologists, because that's what they do. They took a bunch of kids like Benjamin, and they stuck him in a room with his mom. Gave him all the toys he wanted to play with, and then they'd play. And then they had a little light in the corner that they'd flick on, and as soon as the light went on, the mother would literally drop whatever she's doing, get up and walk out the door and close the door. How do you think little Benjamin would like that? He's not a fan. Kids lose it, right? What is going on? My mom just walked out on me. And this experiment's not really that. They have, you know, they have one-way mirrors. They have cameras and stuff like that. Within 2 minutes, they send the mother back into the room. And then this is what they're watching for. So in most kids, in healthiest kids, kids coming from a healthy background, the kid comes running up to mom like, mom, mom, mom. You know, mom picks him up, does the shushing thing that you see moms do, right? Tap, tap, tap. Within minutes, the kid's like showing her different toys. Hey, let's go play. Let's hang out. Let's be together. What they found, though, is there's another group of kids. Same thing. Put the kid in. Send the mom out. Kid starts bawling. Of course, the kid's freaking out. They send the mom back in. But this kid's a little bit different. First, they run to mom, and the mom picks him up and, you know, does the whole shushing and the rocking thing that they do. But the kid's not buying it. They're angry. Instead of calming down and going to the play, the kid just kind of amplifies it. Gets louder and louder. Like, how dare you? I can't believe you did that to me. And the kid's inconsolable. And the theorists realized that the first group of kids, the kids that were easily consoled, they have what's called secure attachment. I've talked about this before. We're wired to be soothed by another human being. When we cry, we're wired to believe that someone's going to come take care of us. And so when that little kid cries, which is what they're supposed to do, and their mom comes back in and takes care of them, they're like, oh, this is all good. But the second group they call anxiously attached. The pain of their mother leaving is so great, so painful, that they can't be soothed after. There's one more group of kids. Put the kid in, played with mom, put the little light on, they walk out. Now, normally kids cry, right? These kids didn't. They would just sit quietly, not move, just sit there. When their mothers came back, it was like they didn't even see their moms. They just ignored them. And they just sat there. And the moms tried to pick him up, and the kid would just kind of be limp and just like wouldn't engage at all. When they did the tests on the kids after, they checked their galvanic response and their blood response, their stress markers are through the roof. These little kids that are silent, they are stressed to the nines. But they have no way to know, or it's like they haven't figured out, they're not capable of learning that their mother can soothe them, can lower their stress. Just like that woman did to the guy in the car, just like Ish and Ishish. Something inside of them got changed, got rewired. And now they can't be soothed by another person. Or it's hard. They call these kids avoidantly attached. Securely attached. Anxiously attached. We know they're stressed, right? Those are the kids that they can't be soothed. And avoidantly attached. Kids that pretend everything's okay. I don't need anything. And their stress numbers are through the roof. Why do I tell you this story? Because later researchers realized that that attachment style that you have as a child continues into your adult relationships. Some of us, we attach really securely. We let other people soothe us. We have great connections of people around us. When I say soul care is about bringing people into your life, you're like, duh, you don't even need to say that, Clausen. Incredible relationships are what my life is about. We're skillful. We're incredible with each other. If I didn't have people around me, I couldn't do it. But there's another group of us that struggle with this. If I'm not careful, I tend towards the avoidant camp. I don't need anything. I'm fine. I'll take care of myself. Feelings? What feelings? There's no such thing as feelings. Right? Or that group that has this constant push-pull. I want you here, but when you leave, that scares me so bad. And there's this push-pull in relationships. We call it drama. That's the adult word for it. Right? I'm breaking up with you. No, you're not. Okay, we're back together again. Okay, I'm breaking up with you. Right? Push-pull. You leave. I'm angry. You don't come home when you say, that scares me. Because it scares me right back to that childhood little kid. And so my reaction is not, hey, can you send me a message? You're going to be running late. It's, ah! I'm inconsolable. So right now you're looking and going, okay, I'm identifying with some of those other groups that aren't super. So does that mean I'm screwed? No, you're not. It means that soul care with people is a little more complex for us. First, we need to know about how our attachment is. We need to know our wounds. For me, one of the big issues I have is how close people are to me. I don't know why it's such an issue for me. When I was younger, man, I could not have people stand close to me. It just drive me nuts. Now, I've worked through it. I can hug people. I'm a hugger. Like a half-ass hugger, but... And if you want me to hug you, kind of go like this, and then I'll know it's hug time, right? If you don't do that, I'm kind of going, I got nothing. I don't know what to do here. Right? But once we learn our issues, we teach them to the people in our lives, our ish-ish, and say, hey, I love you and you're amazing, but just so you know, I got this little thing. You just need to work with me this way or this way. And then we have incredible relationships too. So if you haven't studied your attachment style, if you don't know what's going on, I'll put some resources in the show notes, some books to read, some tests to take. I'm telling you, once you figure this part out, soul care with people just opens up in a way it's never been before. I'm going to close with one last story. This is my story. I was sitting on the couch again, watching TV in the evening. For me, it felt like the 300th time I'd done that. I had no energy. I had no drive. I had no nothing. I was exhausted. I'd get home from work exhausted. I'd force myself to go to the gym. I could barely get through my workout. And then I'd just sit on the couch, literally just like sit on the couch. I didn't want to move. I didn't want to do anything. I had projects just piled up in the corner. Like I couldn't have given any care to them. I was in those, you know, those energy buckets. I was into the bottom one and I was in deep. Now for me, I did this to myself. After my divorce, as a way to deal with it, my counselor gave me approval. She's like, well, it's not the worst way to cope with these things. I started running long distances and doing triathlons. So in 1 year, I did a 25 kilometer running race. Then I broke my arm, and 5 weeks later, I did an Ironman. So that's, what is that, like, I don't know, it's like a long day. It's a really long day. So you swim a bunch, you bike, I think it's 100 kilometers, and then you run a marathon. And then within 6 months, I did what's called the Sinister Seven, which is a 100-mile running race. It takes 28 hours to run it. I had nothing left. Now, the first question you're asking is, why would a human being do that? The answer is, I don't know. I had a lot of feelings I had to run through. But I had nothing left. I was literally like sitting. I had nothing. And you know that feeling, right? Maybe it wasn't running for you, it was school, it was a job, it was kids, it was whatever, it was working through an illness. And you can just feel you're so deep in the hole. And there's just like, I don't even know how to get out of this. And during that time, on my desk at the office, I had a little Coke can. You see, after my divorce, I was out buying flowers for a friend of mine, and I met a florist. I met my ish-ish. She's pretty incredible. She gave me a little can after my first race that said, drink up, you've earned it. through that time when I was sitting on the couch pretty much every day. Every time I'd be mad and be like, I got to get out and do something. Like, it's driving me nuts. She's like, no, you earned it. Just relax. It's okay. Someday she'd just come and sit on the couch next to me and put her head on my shoulder. She didn't ask a whole lot of me. She was just there. I am here today, healthy, full, because of what she brought to my life. I don't want to live in a place where I'm exhausted, I have nothing left, all I can care about is myself. Does anyone, don't put your hands up, but you feeling it? I want my life to have meaning, to have impact in this world, and I want that for each one of you. I want each one of us to do something that makes our world a little bit better. Sometimes it's grand things, sometimes it's just a relationship moment that just shifts to a healthier space. And when our souls, when those buckets of energy are so empty that we have nothing left, we can't do that. Josh talked about stages of faith. He didn't tell you about stage one. Stage one, it's basically selfishness. I'd reverted back to the spiritual stage of stage one. I don't want that for you. I don't want that for the people around you. I don't want that for the world around us. Because if we're there, we have nothing left to give. If we do this work, if we start this process of finding the people in our lives, the ish to our ish, who can recharge us and help us get healthy and full again, we can lift the world up around us. Isn't that a life worth living? Isn't that something worth doing this work for? Because I'm telling you, without that, I don't know that it's going to go to that place. I don't know that our relationships are going to be elevated. I don't know the world around us is going to be lifted up. But if we do this work, if we get into soul care, if we follow the wisdom of the Bible and the wisdom of the psychologist that we're learning, we find health, we find a full soul again, we can change this world and make it better. Amen. Next week, Jeff's going to come back and talk to us about one more aspect of soul care. It's about figuring out who we are. I don't want you guys to miss it because it's a good one. Have a great week. Avoid the snow. And if anyone goes dirt biking next week, give me a shout. See you guys.